So let's see, we're in week seven, and we are this week really going to begin to look more closely at the senses on the basis of what we've been doing before. I was thinking about how much to really try to tie this back into the idea. I just saw Bruce's chat, which I refer you to, right? Despite being, we didn't realize we were all such good Christians, I guess. Okay. Anyway, I was thinking how much to tie this back in, what we're discussing now, to the real focus for the first few weeks during this program, which was working with the field. And that may become more clear as we go along. I mean, it's certainly possible to talk about and to explore and understand what we're looking at in terms of the field of the senses or the field of individual senses. And perhaps that's enough of a connection. But as we talk today, maybe we'll look at it. We'll have some other ways of thinking about it. The reason I was thinking about that, I suppose, is because that seems to me to be a very fruitful way of exploring experience, working with the field. And I don't want to have the sense, I don't want to leave the impression that we're done with that. And, we tried that for a few weeks and now it's time to move on. I'd like to find a way to integrate that more. But we shall see as we go along. So, the focus in this chapter is awareness, really, and the idea that no matter what we're experiencing, awareness is at the base of it. Or you could say that everything manifests awareness, and in particular, that's true for sense experience. So if you think about the world that we inhabit, you could say that it is fundamentally made up of sense experience. And that's especially true if you take, the traditional Buddhist perspective, which says that the mind is also a sense, and that perspective is presented in a very straightforward way. It's not making any kind of esoteric claim. The point is just that when I use my eyes, I see whatever's in my visual field, and when I use my mind, I see whatever arises in my mental field, such as a thought or a memory or an emotion or so on. It's just a way of, the mind is the way we have of gaining access to mental experience, in the same way that the eyes are the way we have of gaining access to visual experience. So in a way, I think it's helpful to bring the mind into this, but for our purposes, well, we will do that off and on. But we really want to focus more on the physical senses because, as Westerners, when we hear the word senses, that's what we're thinking of. So the basic idea in the chapter, the starting point, is that within sensory experience, you can discover the underlying quality of awareness, or at certain points, Rinpoche talks about it as the luminosity of the mind. And he uses a lot of imagery about light, the light of the opening, he says at the bottom of page 387. And that's kind of where we want to go, because the basic idea here is that we have a way of of engaging sensory experience, and it's based on actually you might say a dimming down of the light of awareness. We shape awareness in a certain way through senses, through the ordinary. Through the operation of the senses as we ordinarily understand them, I see this, I see that, I touch this, I smell that. There's a particular world that we're used to, and it's completely ingrained in our experience. It's so fundamental. You know, I suppose you could say that babies spend a tremendous amount of energy in the first year or two of life, getting that straight, getting a sense of what the world that's available to the senses is like. And by getting it right, really I'm saying coming into agreement with what everybody else thinks, understanding sense experience in the way that human beings understand sense experience. And so we live in that kind of dimmed down world, and what Rinpoche is exploring here is the possibility that we could open it back up, that and we want to investigate what that means and how one might go about doing it. So he starts off the chapter with this image about rolling out an object with its specific shape and form, he says, and rolling it out as though it were made of a ball of clay. And it becomes thinner and thinner, and it becomes translucent, and in the end, there's very little to distinguish it from the space that's outside it. So that's a kind of a rough image, it seems to me. I mean, the question is, let's think of a vase. You take a vase and you roll it out. Well, the first thing that happens, if you think about our ordinary way of understanding, is that you flatten it, right? And the moment you've flattened it, it's no longer a vase. And I don't think that that's what Rinpoche is really pointing to, although that's what this image kind of suggests. I think it's more, the issue is more, if you could imagine rolling out the object without changing the shape and form of it. It's not like the vase, which originally was 6 inches tall, gets to be 18 inches tall and then 36 inches tall and then 100 feet tall and so on. I mean, that's one way of looking at it. But I think it's more, in terms of what Rinpoche is pointing to, I think it's more helpful if you say, you roll it out, you make it more translucent without affecting the shape. We don't, there's no particular way we could imagine doing that, but you can kind of imagine the results of doing that. And I think that becomes more clear when in the second paragraph where he stops talking about an object and he says the mind, So we start off with a physical object, and in the next paragraph, he says it's really the same thing. And I think this is getting more to the point of the approach that he's taking. He says the mind has its objects, its content. Thought has content, or we focus on something, and it may be something we see in the sense field, and so that becomes the content of what the mind is doing. Whatever the mind is doing, the content that it experiences is still mind. And he says that in just a parenthetical expression, but I think it's the most important point in this second paragraph. He says, when a thought comes up or we give someone something attention or energy, the mind focuses in on its content, which is still mind, in a way that determines shape and form. And then he says, if we could settle into awareness in a way that was lighter or had a wider focal setting, and that's referring back to the idea of rolling out an object as though it were a ball of clay, right? You open up the focal setting, or you engage with the content of experience in a way that is lighter, that is not. And the word lighter here is a really interesting word. It's one that Rinpoche plays with because it's got these two meanings in English. It's very convenient. So one has to do with light, like sunlight, and the other one has to do with it's not being as heavy. So it allows Rinpoche to, in different places in the TSK books, he talks about the gravity of thinking. You know, the world that we identify, that we label, and so on, has a kind of a gravity to it, or you could just say a kind of a heaviness, and that heaviness is it has to do with the claim that this is the way things really are. And so it turns out to be really important, that little expression in parentheses that says the content of whatever goes on in the mind, or the content of our experience, because the mind is always labeling experience, and that's what we discover in the world, that content is not heavy, and is not dense, in the sense of being impenetrable to light. That content is just mind. And you know, it's interesting because this is a point that gets discussed a lot in Western epistemology, and also Buddhist epistemology. So the issue is, what do we really know, or how can we know, or what is the validity of what we claim to know? That's what epistemology is all about, right? And there are many positions that people take about this, and you could say, well, this is just one particular position that Rinpoche is presenting here, and other people might argue with it. But the thing that is so interesting and sets TSK apart from you know, philosophical styles of inquiry is that Rinpoche is really saying, experientially, what do we discover? It's not just a theory about how knowledge works. So when you say that the objects we discover through the senses, or the objects that we discover in our mind, like such as thoughts, when you say that those are still mind, you're inviting an experiential inquiry. You're saying, well, look for yourself. And when we look for ourselves, the first thing that you see, I think, in kind of a ordinary common sense perspective, is that there's this, in fact, it's not like that at all. You know, our ordinary understanding is, I'm looking around me, and I'm touching things. And I think those are the two fundamental senses. I mean, hearing is really fundamental too. But sometimes we notice the sounds around us, and sometimes we don't. Or sometimes we, you know, even now you're listening to me talk, but you're not so much noticing the sound of my voice, except that it's a little hoarse, so maybe you're noticing that. But, you know, you're listening to the words, and the sound is very, very secondary. So ordinarily, I think what we're most focused on is what we see. And also, but again, in kind of a sub rosa level, what's a simpler way of saying that? You know, a kind of an assumed level, the things that we touch. You know, we're sitting in a chair, perhaps, most of us probably. So we're touching that chair. We don't think about it much, but it's there. It's available, that sense of touching, if we want to look, if we want to go in that direction. But whatever we look at, whatever we touch, and whatever we hear, and so on. Although hearing's different, and we'll talk about that. I mean, I think hearing's an interesting example. But let's focus on touching and seeing for now. Whatever we see or touch, we say, well, that's a thing. You know, that's a solid thing out there. I mean, I've got my computer in front of me, and I've got, you know, I'm sitting at a desk, so I've got a printer, and I've got a phone, and I can reach out and touch them, and I say, all of those things are really different from the mind, the consciousness, the awareness that is taking it in. And there's this subject-object display, and this is not news to any of you. But I think it's good to be very, very tuned into the fact that that's how we experience the world. So what Rinpoche says is that a more accurate description of our experience is that whatever we see or touch or think about is still mind, is still consciousness, is still awareness. And all three of those three words are a little different from each other and have different consequences maybe, but for our purposes, I think we can use them all. So when I see the printer over on my left, it's not as though the mind has reached out, you know. It's not as though there's some active force in the mind that physically travels to the printer. The Greeks apparently had a theory kind of like that, but that's a theory. I guess you could hold that theory, but you know that's not exactly. I mean, you could say that because it's closer to what I'm about to say, but that's one possibility. It's also not the case that the printer projects some little smaller model of itself, you know, this little printer image makes its way through the optical nerve into the brain, and there in the brain we have this little printer image. It's really not like that. What happens is, you can say, this is the suggestion, that the mind is constructing an image of the printer, or probably a better way to say it, and here's one place we can talk about fields. The mind looks at the printer, and there's this kind of field of possibilities that it engages, which is the field of the things that I see around me, you know, the potential, the world around me with all of its objects that are available as potential objects for visual engagement. So the mind activates that field, and now the printer becomes accessible. But that accessibility of the printer is still a mental event, and I don't know, I feel like I'm starting to drive that point into the ground. I mean, you know, that I've maybe said too much about it, or as much as anybody else, as much as we'd really want to say. But it's important, and I want to, you know, I want for people to be able to at least entertain that that notion that that what we see is itself an expression of awareness. And the easiest way to see that, I guess I'm still sticking with that, the easiest way to see that is with objects of the mind. So I'm going to do this with the printer, but maybe you can do it with something else in your visual field right now. You look at it, and then you close your eyes and form an image of it. And that image may be more or less accurate, but that image that you've formed, and you can open your eyes now, that image that you've formed is clearly, in that case, just a mental image, right? So the issue is, what about the printer that we see sitting on the desk or whatever object it was you looked at? And the idea is that that too is a mental image. It may have a different origin, you know, it may have, or it may, and that sense of having a different origin has to do with the field of potential physical objects for us to see in the world. But the process is the same. It's still an issue. It's still the awareness of the mind. And so that's the easiest place to see that is with the mind, with mental images. I think probably mental images. You could say that with thoughts. We could explore that. But it seems like the next easiest place to see it is with physical objects in the world that we actually see, because we can go through this little discussion that we had a couple of minutes ago where you say, well, if I look at the printer in front of me, it's not as though the printer actually enters my field of, you know, enters the brain. So there must be an image that's created, and that must be a mental image. And there are arguments, as I say, philosophically, you can go back and forth on that. But we're saying there is certainly something about that image that means or that makes sense only if we understand it as itself being an aspect of awareness. Now, that seeing, let's look for a moment or turn for a moment to touching. Because with touching, it's a little bit less clear, but I want to suggest that the same process operates with regard to touching. So if I reach out and touch my printer's on my desk, so it's only about a foot and a half away from me. So if I reach out and touch it, and you may want to reach out and touch something else, we say, well, gee, there's an immediacy to that. Somehow it seems like, I'm the vareness, the solidity of the printer connects up in our minds with a basic sense that it's really there. It's not the mind. It's a thing in itself. But if you look at it just a little, or if you reflect on it a little bit, you recognize that something is being constructed in the mind. There are impressions, and I'm touching it with my fingers, and certain nerve cells in the fingers are being activated, and so information flows up to the brain and so on. And the fact that that gets interpreted then as a thing out there in the world, namely a printer, is in fact an interpretation. You might say, well, my body is real, and my nerve, the experience, the information that's communicated through the senses, through the nerves, that seems somehow solid. But the things that I contact through contacting the world, through optically or through the physical, what do you call that, through the sense of touch, that's an interpretation. That's how I make sense out of the information that flows into me. And then as to the body, you'd say, well, really the same thing applies. I have an internal sense of being embodied, but it's an interpretation of certain information that's being presented. And then in the end, you wind up asking the question, does that mean that the brain is the only real thing? There's an example, a hypothetical they use in philosophy, where they say, well, in theory, you could operate on someone, remove their brain, put it in a vat full of nutrients, and connect up the nerves in the right way, and then you could stimulate those nerves, and the person would never realize that they were just a brain in a vat, because they would still be having the same kinds of mental impressions. But even that doesn't go far enough, because the notion that the brain is what causes mental events to arise may be a perfectly good explanation. We don't need to concern ourselves with that. But it's only an explanation. It's not, if you could do that experiment, maybe you would have some grounds for coming to a conclusion as to exactly how good an explanation it is. But the actual experience has nothing to do with brain, It has to do with it being located in a place behind the eyes, and that makes it natural to think that it's the brain, because we know that that's where the brain is located. But we don't experience the brain. We don't experience senses traveling up the nerves to the brain and all of that. So in terms of our experience, we're looking at mental experience and we're looking at awareness. So let me look at a couple of questions that have been asked. Asanga, okay. Sudaba's raising a question that's based on a story told in the Buddhist tradition about a great master who meditated for many years and finally had a vision of one of the bodhisattvas. At first he saw it as a dog, but then through an act of compassion, he saw it as Maitreya, as the Bodhisattva. And she asks the question, so is the cause, is the real explanation, you might say, for our experience, our mental experience, the karma, the patterns, the we have activated through past actions? And I think the answer to that is yes. If you're interested in explaining things in terms of physical conditions, like the brain being present and, the body operating properly and so on, then you can explain it that way. If you're interested in explaining why some people are able to see things in a certain way and other people aren't, then you could explain it in terms of past conditioning, and you don't have to look at Buddhist examples. An example that sometimes, well, that I just saw recently is if a lumberman walks into a forest, he sees, the potential for lumber. Whereas if a what do you call it, an ornitholog walks into a forest, he sees it as potential nesting places for birds. And if we walk into a forest, we see it in other ways. So yes, it's in terms of your conditioning and your interests and so on. There's all sorts of things that determine that. And David asks, could you say that touch is constructed as a sensation which is experienced as an event in mental space? Yeah, you could. That might be a useful way to think about it. I mean, I'd have to kind of, you would have to ask, we would have to ask, what are the consequences of looking at it in that way? The idea that the experience we have is an experience in mental space, I think is very reasonable and relevant. And Rinpoche goes on in this chapter to talk about the relationship between awareness and space, and I think it points in that direction. So maybe we'll get to that in a moment. And Bruce asks a question here. So he says that in Advaita Vedanta teachings, they suggest that mind isn't in the head, that the head, the body, and everything else is in awareness. And he asks, is that close to what I'm suggesting? Yes, I think it is. The idea that awareness is central. There are different traditions, and Vedanta is one. There are different traditions that talk about it that way, and there are aspects of Buddhist thought that talk about it that way. I want to emphasize, though, that we're saying, PSK is saying, it's not so much an explanation. I'm sure this is true in Vedanta also. It's not that the explanation is right or wrong. The question is, what if you experienced the world in that way? And that goes back to the first image, which says, what if you could roll an object out, or let's get away from that particular image and say, what if you could make an object transparent in the sense that what you discover, what you engage, what you encounter when you see that object is a manifestation of awareness. And the bridge between those two, and Rinpoche is very clear about this in this chapter, the bridge between the object as we usually see it and the awareness which makes it possible to see is the senses. Because we have the sense of sight, we encounter the world that's available to sight. And so sight is a particular aspect of, or a particular formulation of awareness. The way Rinpoche describes that, let's see if I can find it here, let's see, I'm not finding it right away, but he has a phrase in here about the senses being a kind of a characteristic arc. Oh, here it is. It's on page 390 of the first full paragraph. He says, the senses have their own momentum, curving naturally in a trajectory directed toward knowing the world. And he describes that in two different directions, which again have to do with, what is your sense of concerns and interests? What your concerns and interests are will determine how you want to describe it. He says one way of understanding this, the role that the senses play in giving awareness a particular shape, is to think about the infant emerging from the womb and reaching out to explore a world. Another way, another level of explanation for that is what he says in the next sentence. He says there's a kind of there's a wanting, and this is related to the idea of the infant, but it's taking it in a different direction, or going into more detail. There's a wanting and a not having, and that's one way of talking about the sense that there are objects out there in the world. The senses represent a shaping of awareness in light of the wants and desires and needs of the infant, and then ultimately the human being, or the sentient being, you could say. So if you look at the next paragraph, the last sentence in the next paragraph, let's look at the couple of sentences. He says, he's talking about the senses and how they operate. And they, actually, let's look at the whole paragraph. He says, the outward momentum of sense faculties, propagated through the medium that we identify as space. So this is physical space. And the senses, we're not talking about mind now, we're talking about the physical senses. So physical senses do their sensing in physical space. You know, the field in which the senses operate is the field of physical space. That's really what he's saying here. Okay. And he says, the sense faculties propagated through the medium that we identify as space propel awareness outward as well. And that's really the kind of the heart of what I'm trying to point to here, is that awareness is given a particular shape and form. And one way of talking about that is the way that I was using at the beginning today, when I said it's a kind of a dimming down of the underlying quality of light that awareness manifests. Maybe that's too judgmental. You know, to go from light to dark in the sense of dimming down. But I think it's pretty much implicit in the idea of taking specific form. And the specific form that it takes is an existent world, the world that's available to the senses. And again, you could think of that as a field. So if we keep going with this paragraph, he says, what is sensed is divided from what is not sensed, what appears from what does not appear. So a certain field of possibilities opens up. It's the field that's available to the physical senses. What is known is accorded a status equal to the awareness that the senses embody, while awareness is proclaimed to enjoy a status akin to what is known. The original demand of the originating momentum establishes what appears together with awareness as being existent. So what happens is that awareness takes a particular form, and it's the form that's appropriate to existent objects in the world. And again, you know, we have to stop and look back at awareness, at objects, at mental objects, so things we think about or things we remember or things we imagine. But you know, that's a big topic in itself, but maybe a simple thing to say about it that seems to me accurate is that we understand the mental world, the world of images and thoughts and emotions. Emotions are different, but let's not go into that. We understand them by analogy to the physical world. So, you know, again, if I'm looking at the printer on my desk, or I touch the printer on my desk, and then I close my eyes and I imagine the printer on the desk, and actually it's interesting to take that one step further and say, what if I imagine touching the printer on the desk? That's a very different kind of imagining. So that's worth looking at. But in any event, that's by analogy. You know, we make sense out of the mental world by analogy to the physical world. And in each case, we say, okay, it's an existent world. There are specific things. They have their own way of existing. And the awareness that encounters them is the awareness that's consistent with that way of existing. And in effect, and that's what Rinpoche says here, in effect, we wind up saying that awareness exists, or a more standard way of saying it would be to say awareness takes a particular form, and that form is the form that's appropriate to contacting, engaging, identifying the world that exists out there, or the world that exists in my head. And that's what happens to awareness, and that's what I meant when I said it gets dimmed down. And another way of saying that, as I said, if that seems too judgmental, is it gets restricted, it gets limited. We understand the possibilities for awareness in terms of the awareness that's possible within a particular field. And that's what Rinpoche talks about at the end, at the bottom of page 390. And he says, well, in a certain sense, and I want to keep it open, whether this is the final statement on the matter. He says, in a certain sense, awareness has to have something to encounter, in the same way that light has to bounce off an object. Light, when it's traveling through space, is not light. That is to say, you can't see it; it's invisible. Light becomes light when it encounters an object. And that's what he says about awareness, and he specifically calls it here the light of awareness, which helps make that clear. So he says, only as objects appear to the senses, creating a reflecting surface, can awareness, quote, come into being. And I think the quotes, so many things in the TSK books get put in these scare quotes, these single quotation marks. In this case, I think it's a great, it's very helpful to do that, because it's pointing to the phrase. Awareness comes into being. That's exactly what happens. There's awareness, and awareness enters being, and in the sense, in the course of doing that, it becomes a particular kind of awareness, or it's a particular set of possibilities for awareness, and that means that other possibilities may well have been left out. And Rinpoche discusses that here when he says the outcome of this specific mode of coming into being is an awareness that is mine. Right? So the way in which all of this unfolds is that there's going to be someone out there, or I really better to say someone in here, who is activating that awareness. I am aware of something. And then, of course, the way we see that is I see something, right? I touch something, I smell something. That becomes our standard model. And at the top of page 391, he says, knower and known emerge together, supporting one another's candidacy for being. And then he says, kind of playing with the words a little, he says, this initial candidacy is then accorded accreditation. I'm not sure if he's really thinking here of how schools get accredited, but first they're candidates, and then they're accredited, and that's the image he's using here. And he points out that it's related to wanting. Now, we're almost out of time. We didn't have any time today to do a practice, which I think is generally a good idea, but people have been actively engaging and asking questions, so that's great. I appreciate that. There are a couple of things to a couple of conclusions to draw in terms of what do we do with this analysis? Where do we go? So there are two things. One is, he suggests a particular way of experimenting, and this is back on page 388, in the second full paragraph. He's talking about the capacity for the mind, and he's still, the way the chapter is structured is that in the beginning he wants us to understand that awareness is really central, and that the light of awareness is available, and that we could encounter it. And then in the later part of the chapter, which is what we have just been looking at, he points out how that gets directed and channeled, and in a particular way that turns awareness into my awareness. on the basis of certain kinds of concerns. So if we go back toward the beginning of the chapter, and he's still looking, he's still inviting us to explore the possibility that awareness could be something very different. In the second full paragraph, and the one that follows that also, the next couple of paragraphs actually, he raises some possibilities, and they have to do with not accepting the fundamental way of engaging experience in terms of a subject and object, but doing it in terms of time and space and knowledge. And these two paragraphs are actually quite similar, I think, to, for those of you who are familiar with this, to exercise 14, I think it is, in the first TSK book, Space-Time Knowledge on the Conventional Level, and exercise 47 in the Love of Knowledge book is like that too, where he basically says you don't have to engage things in terms of objects in the world that the senses encounter. You can instead engage them as he says here, in such a way that each object is space and each event is time, and the separation between knower and known, not the knowing of the knower, but the separation between the knower and the known as knowledge. So that's a practice, and that would be good to explore. Now he gives you a little clue that it may not be so easy to do that. He says, patiently cultivated and applied in daily interactions, such a non-standard way of experiencing could shift awareness to the quality of experience itself. So you need to be patient. And it's a good idea to explore that, as he says, in daily interactions. In other words, in the world, you say, well, what would it be like? What would it be like? I'm leaning back in my armchair here, as you can see on the video. You know, it's actually my desk chair. But you say, well, gee, I wonder about that. You know, what would it be like if I experienced the world in terms of space and time and knowledge, rather than in terms of objects that are known by a knower? So that's one particular practice. It's a very wonderful, fundamental, basic practice, and I encourage you to work with that. The other thing that he suggests, and I mean, you could pull a lot of different practices out of here, but the one I want to pull out is in the later part of the chapter, where he's describing more how the senses operate and how they really set up the world in a particular way in terms of an awareness that's mind and objects that the senses know, and the momentum of the senses, which is based on a wanting to know and moves towards existence, all those things that we discussed. You can explore that in terms of how that structure of things being inherently divided gets set up. And he says at the top of page 390, about 5 lines down, he says, we know awareness only in such specific forms, in other words, through the senses that know. Right? He says, if we look for an awareness that sponsors the activity of the senses, we will not readily be able to contact it. So within the ordinary operation of the senses, which does divide things up, so there's something I see in front of me, there's something I touch, and there's always this two-part structure. Within that, we can discover awareness, but you know, we don't, the suggestion here is that we not try too hard to get rid of our ordinary understanding, but rather within our ordinary understanding, within our ordinary way of engaging the world through the senses, within that divided world, we discover the quality of awareness manifesting just in things as they are, just in our experience as it is. And you could do that with vision, you could do it with touch, and although we didn't talk about it this time, you could do that with sound, and sound brings in a different dimension, because the thing about sound is that it's not so readily attributed to a particular source. I mean, it is. We always name things. We hear a car going by and we say, oh, there's a car going by. But that's at a kind of remove. You know, when I see the computer screen, there's no doubt that I'm seeing the computer screen. Okay, that's a big topic, or at least it's a big enough topic so that I don't want to go into it now because we've already been going on for a while and I've been running on. So anyway, that would be the practice. Look, if you go back to the top of 390, this sense that the place we're going to find awareness is in the ordinary operation of the senses. And then the more, what could you say, the practice which invites us to kind of blow up that usual structure is to say, well, look at experience not in terms of that usual structure, but in terms of space and time and knowledge. So over the next week, perhaps you can explore one or the other of those, or both, or go back and forth between the two, and see how that works for you. And then we're going to continue now in the next couple of weeks. We'll be focusing pretty strongly on the senses. So that's it for today. Thank you very much.